On today's Money with Friends podcast, Middle East tensions pump up oil prices. Should you pay attention to stuff like this? There's always news. Special guest Rich Jones from Paychecks and Balances and I will talk about that. And then, and maybe even more important, and something we can't help but pay attention to, new CNBC study with Charles Schwab shows that 62% of millennials are living paycheck to paycheck. How do you make that not be you? That and more on today's Money with Friends podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Money with Friends. I am Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins from my mom's half-finished basement in Detroit, Michigan.
And I'm Rich Jones from Paychecks and Balances coming from my bedroom closet in Mountain View, California.
We have such sexy places we work from, Rich. This is the show where we cover not one, but two headlines ripped from the current financial press. We not only read them like some podcasts do, we talk about them. We talk about what they mean to your money. We also do it live in front of a Facebook audience. So if you'd like to hang out with us while we make a podcast, feel free to join us at facebook.com/iStackBenjamins, and maybe you'll make the next show. Today's show is brought to you by Acre Trader Farmland Investing. Investing in farmland simplified. For more on Acre Trader, we'll talk about it a little bit more on the show. Head to acretrader.com/MWF. That's Money with Friends. acretrader.com/MWF. It is a great day here in Money with Friends territory because we have the one, the only, the busiest man in Hollywood. Mr. Rich Jones is here from Paychecks and Balances.
Joe, thanks so much for having me on, man. Looking forward to having a good time.
Well, I'm happy you're here. I'm happy everybody's here hanging out with us. So tell everybody, the three people that don't know about Paychecks and Balances, what you and Marcus do over there.
Yeah, so we're a personal finance and career advice podcast with the goal of helping people save money, make money, and get out of debt, all while having some fun along the way. We don't purport to be financial experts. We're just two good guys. Well, I guess even that's debatable, but I'll say two good guys who've made some bad financial decisions and also some good ones along the way. So we really emphasize the experiences that we've had. We keep it light. We keep it fun. And when we talk to guests, we make sure that we kind of keep it at a basic fundamental level so that terms, jargon aren't going over people's heads. And yeah, we've been doing the show for over 3 years now. So it's crazy to think that that much time has went by, especially given that our anniversary is in March. So
that's
still
amazing.
Trucking along, still helping people. And yeah, still rising.
Well, and on one hand, it feels like you guys have been a member of the community forever because you're such an integral part of the community. But on the other side, it feels like yesterday you guys were just starting.
I know. It's crazy. And the whole reason I found out about the FinCon community was from going to Podcast Movement in Chicago. And I actually got a scholarship to the first FinCon and have been a member of the community since then. And also Marcus and I, we've been podcasting together since 2013. We had a previous show before this that I won't go into because some of that content might be a little bit. Yeah. And the first time that we actually met in person was at FinCon in 2016. So he's in Austin, Texas. I'm in California, was in New York when we first started. And yeah, we've been doing it virtually and have been going strong ever since.
That's so awesome. Well, we're going strong today on two headlines, one that Rich picked, one that I picked. So let's see who's going to kick off today's show for us.
Money headlines explained 3 days a week. That means you're tuned in to Money with Friends.
In our first headline, and we'll start with mine first because I think that we're really going to dive into the one Rich brought to the table. This comes to us from Kiplinger. Middle East tensions pump up oil prices. Very short piece, but we see these headlines all the time, Rich, and I thought that I would bring this to the table because, you know, people wonder if we should pay attention to these. So why don't I dig into it and we'll dig into that question. This is written by Kyle Woodley. Kyle writes, energy stocks shouted over the rest of the market's noise last Thursday Wednesday amid rising tensions in the Middle East. The U.S. Navy assisted two oil tankers that reportedly were attacked in the Straits of Hormuz just a day after Iran-aligned Yemeni rebels hit a Saudi Arabia airport with a cruise missile. The regional developments set U.S. crude oil prices up 2.2% to $52.22 per barrel, which in turn pulled Dow Components ExxonMobil and Chevron slightly higher. However, leading the charge for the industrial average, which finished up 0.4, was Disney. And then it goes even further into other things that last Thursday were in the news. And, you know, we see headlines like this. I mean, Kiplinger puts this out every day about what happened in the market. I kind of think this stuff is simplified. I mean, I think that the way this is written, it's like, well, here's why this stuff kind of happened. I don't think we really know why stuff happens. Do you? Do you think there's really, you know, that these people really know why stocks went higher or lower?
No, I don't. And I remember as I was reading through the article, I was going and trying to research myself and say, OK, so what does this mean? So how exactly does that factor into what's happening in my 401k? And I think just in general, people, they see headlines like this. And because violence and some of these things are so common, they just scroll right past them. And I know yeah. that I actually try to avoid the news in some ways just because I find it so depressing. So this is probably something, it's one of those headlines that I saw, immediately swiped left to get it off my screen and didn't really think much more about it until I read the article that you sent me. And I imagine there's a lot of other people who probably operate the same way.
Yeah. And what's funny is, though, this does affect our daily life. I mean, oil prices are going to go up because of these attacks. Not only does that mean that prices are going to go up, but that also sent stocks higher. And what's funny about this is that these dominoes, I think, don't act the way people think they're going to act. Whenever you have this strife, you would think that prices would go down for these oil companies. Why does it go up? Because you and I know that whenever there's a problem, every gas station on earth jacks up the price immediately because we all see the headline and we expect it. And then they're always slow to bring the price back down, right? So this is the horrible thing. I think it's a money-making opportunity. I mean, it's horrible stuff happening in the Gulf over there, and yet it's a money-making opportunity for these companies.
And that's the part that I honestly can say I didn't understand, because I was thinking, yes, that the stock prices would go down, because when companies have issues, you know, and something comes out in the news, that's normally what you see. Whereas in this situation, my first thought was actually what's going to happen to me at the pump.
Right.
Not what's going to happen in my portfolio, not what this means in terms of other financial goals that I have, but how is this going to affect me in my day-to-day life? And so for those that maybe heat or cool their homes, well, I guess heat their homes with oil, you know, that's going to be something that's going to come to mind for them. They're probably not going to think of their investment portfolio first when they read a headline like this.
No, but that is interesting. It's going to affect your budget too. And if you drive to work, I'm thinking about, you know, Scott Trench from Bigger Pockets?
Yes.
You know, he talks about riding his bike, living close enough to be able to ride his bike to work. I don't know how close you live versus
10
where you
minutes.
Live.
And it's the first time in my life that I've been this close to work. I'm used to commuting an hour. So 10 minutes. It's a dream, I'm telling you.
Could you ride a bike?
I could in 20 minutes, but then I'd have to shower when I get to work, and I'd rather have those extra 10 minutes in bed.
I started riding my bike to work back when I was a financial planner the last few months I did it. And I got lucky because I had a gym next to me and I felt good. It was great. It sometimes didn't work out at night because I would come out of my office sometimes. And I remember one time there was a severe thunderstorm. Cheryl, my spouse, was doing something with the kids, so she couldn't pick me up. I had two choices: wait until this stuff ended, which was going to be, you know, 2 or 3 hours later, or just suck it up and go. So I remember having the most thrilling bicycle ride of my life in a raging thunderstorm, lightning all over the place. It was not my finest hour.
Yeah, that sounds super risky. I mean, and I'm also terrified out here of just traffic in general, because I'll say the drivers out here aren't the best, and there's just a lot more traffic in the area that I operate. But you see some interesting bikes out here, and you can imagine it's Silicon Valley.
Oh yeah,
you'll see people low to the ground in some tri-type traction with their phone propped up in front of them, so they're riding along and watching YouTube or watching something else. So yeah, it gets pretty innovative with the biking out here, but a lot of people do that.
So here's a question, though, back to the piece before we do our takeaway on this first piece. Do you So do you read the stuff, or should you be reading the stuff or not?
I think you should have a general idea of what's going on. But also, I think as far as investments go, you need to be familiar with what's in your portfolio. And I'll say that I'm someone who hadn't thought a whole lot about that really until recently, because some folks kind of set it and forget it. And they don't understand that these things that may be happening on a day-to-day or a weekly basis might actually be impacting what's happening with the money that they have invested.
Yeah, and that might be a good takeaway. I don't know if you have a different takeaway or if that's probably your big idea for this piece.
Yeah, that's the big one for me, is understanding what's actually in your portfolio, because like I was saying, I kind of set and forget mine. Yeah. And so after I read this, I actually went in and said, how much of my stuff actually is in energy? How is this causing movement in terms of what's happening with what's already there? So a lot of people, I think they do the set and forget. They see the news piece, they scroll past it, or maybe they read it and then they just go about their life, or they think about what the immediate implication of that will be. So gas pump. Yeah. Or oil prices for their home, and not what that might mean in the long-term picture of their wallet.
Yeah, and my takeaway is something that we touched on tangentially, which is that don't try to guess where your portfolio is going to go based on any of this news, because these stocks often don't perform the way that you would initially expect them to perform. Stocks are going to go in a different way than you may think. So don't play that game. You see experts that get beat in that game. OG and I were doing a story for Stacking Benjamins where we were looking at macroeconomics and how these economists that do it all the time, none of them expected interest rates to be where they are today. Like none of them. And these people are highly paid, top people in their field. If they can't get it, there's no way you're going to get it.
Leave it alone.
I want to say hi to everybody who's hanging out with us on Facebook land today. Kimberly's here. Hey, Kimberly. We also have, I think Kimberly's in North Dakota. We had two dogs and a camper here. That sounds crowded, doesn't it? our friend Ryan is here. We've got Kevin here. Kevin is in, Ryan's in San Diego. Kevin is in Mexico, I think. We got Gregory here. I believe he's on the East Coast. James is here with us. James says it feels weird seeing Rich as opposed to hearing them. So you got a fan in James there. Gregory, Gregory's here, says, hey, Rich and Joe, having the first name Rich should be a basic qualification for being a financial planner.
And it's funny how long I've spent broke.
maybe miss your calling though. And Richard's here with us from LA. Glad you guys are here. And if you've got comments on these, feel free to jump in. In fact, Richard does have a comment. It says, I work for an oil refinery and I invest regardless of where my industry is at. It's funny, Richard, to your point, you know, sector investing is very difficult, even for people that are in the industry. And I often, you know, even though I like, and you guys, I'm sure at Google have ESPP, an employee stock purchase plan.
It's actually 401k match. We don't have an ESPP.
Gotcha. You know, I like working at a company. I like taking advantage of company stock, but I also like diversifying away from it when I get, you know, more. I don't want to have more than like 5 to 10% of my portfolio in a company I work in, and B, all in the same sector. I get afraid of that.
So quick correction there. So I realize I said 401k. We do get restricted stock units.
Gotcha.
As part of our compensation.
Yeah. And so keeping that to 5 to 10% of your portfolio, fantastic. Putting all your money in Google stock and you're paid by them when you work for them. If it comes crashing down, which I don't think Google's going to anytime soon, but if it comes crashing down, everything crashes down at once and we don't want that.
But a lot of people do that. They get their stock on whatever basis and it goes into either a Morgan Stanley or I think the other one is, it might be E-Trader, and they just let their Google stock sit there and collect and never think about moving it out.
I saw it all the time. I worked with a bunch of Microsoft people when I was in Detroit, and they do the same stuff with Microsoft stock. Job one was to stop doing it. And it's not about it being a good or bad stock. It's just not having everything in one spot like that. All right. That's my headline, Rich. Time for yours, man.
Yes. So as you kind of queued up front, 62% of millennials are living paycheck to paycheck. This piece is written by Megan Leonhardt, and it reads, almost two-thirds of millennials say they're living paycheck to paycheck, and only 38% feel financially stable, according to a new survey by Charles Schwab. Millennials, more than any other generation surveyed by Schwab, feel the most insecure when it comes to their finances. That's according to roughly 380 millennials ages 23 to 38, surveyed by Schwab's 2019 Modern Wealth Report. Yet millennials also say they spend an average of $478 a month on non-essential purchases such as dining out, entertainment, luxury items, and vacation. That's less than the $587 Gen Xers report spending, but more than the $359 spent by baby boomers. Quote, it may seem odd that when we look at statistics that say so many millennials are living paycheck to paycheck, but on the other hand, they're overspending, says Farnoosh Torabi, personal finance author and host of the So Money podcast. But while it may seem counterintuitive, it's the reality many millennials face, she says. When your financial life is in disarray, chances are you will overspend, she tells CNBC Make It. Emotions around money lead us to make irrational choices. And that's where I wanted to stop and have a bit of discussion. But what's your initial reaction to that?
I love Farnoosh a lot, but I think she has it backwards. I mean, because I've been in this situation where I was living paycheck to paycheck. You know, she says your life is in disarray because your finances are in disarray. I think your finances being in disarray are more a symptom of a bigger issue going on. I mean, I don't think that this itself is the issue. I mean, I remember when I was paycheck to paycheck, man, my whole life was in disarray.
Yeah. So that's what's interesting. I actually go more along with what she said, because even now, for as much as I've learned from the various guests that we've spoken to, from the mistakes that I've made, when my life gets crazy, I fall back into old habits. And so yeah. I think that's common for people, that whatever you do when you get uncomfortable, whatever you do when you feel like you're spiraling out of control, people tend to go back into their comfort zone. And for me, I'm a natural spender, and I'm an emotional spender. And that's something that I really had to acknowledge about myself.
Me too.
So even after, you know, I got to the point that I got myself out of debt. Yes. I had my budget set or spending plan or whatever term you want to use to make it sound more friendly. But I've noticed as I've had different bumps in the road, you can actually look at my bank account and you can tell when my life was crazy just based off of what I've been spending on and how much I've been spending during that time period.
I think we're saying the same thing, but for me, it was backward. My life was in such disarray that I would go to emotional spending, as an outlet. You know, I was overspending on stuff that were wants, not needs. And it was mostly because of the fact that as an example, I'd be working my butt off at a dead end job, trying to make $2, and I'm worried about what I'm going to eat tomorrow, but I'd be so fried at the end of the day, beating my head against a wall, that I go out to dinner instead of making food at home.
Oh, and okay. So I think we are saying the same thing.
Yeah. Because
that's exactly what will happen to me. And I can think about, so I'm not going to lie and say that I cook aggressively now, because I still do not. But you know, when I think about when I was in my last role, and yes, loved my team, you know, loved that world, but wanted to make a change, that there were weeks where I didn't cook. And there were weeks where I kind of fell behind on podcast things, and I fell behind on making phone calls to family and friends just because what was going on in my life was so crazy. And yeah, it led to exactly that, where there were times I'd buy groceries. So this was a double whammy. I would buy groceries, put them in the freezer, be too tired to cook, and then they would end up spoiling.
Yeah.
So I would lose the money from the groceries that I bought that spoiled, but then I was also spending $20 to $30 on food. And then factored into that is I'm using a service like DoorDash because I'm too tired to drive to whatever restaurant it is to get the food, that now I'm paying this delivery fee, this tax, and this other restaurant fee, all in the interest of trying to preserve my mental sanity.
Talking to Grant Sabatier, when he came through Detroit a few weeks ago, he said that in New York City, these, you know, Uber Eats, DoorDash, whatever the food delivery thing is, the number one thing people have delivered in New York City, according to Grant, is guess what?
Food. Pizza.
No. But what type of food?
Chinese food.
Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
What?
I know.
I haven't even seen that on a mint. See, no, that you got to make it. Come on. Yes. Come on now. PBJ.
That's according to Grant. I haven't fact checked him, but Grant's a really smart guy. Wrote a great book, and you look at that stuff, but okay, that's cart before the horse. But I still think that for me, the whole key was getting the other aspects of my life lined up, where I was no longer beating my head against a wall for tomorrow, finding a little bit of sanity time. Working on getting a raise at work first and then finding a career that was going to more support a better lifestyle. And then at the same time, working on financial controls. But I still think, and this is the only place where I take issue with what Farnoosh said, if I wouldn't have focused on those things and I would have focused on my financial controls, I mean, you only have so much room for so many decisions. I want to make that income stream better first, work on financial controls to take care of my bigger pocketbook.
I like what you said there because it makes me think of solving for the root of the problem.
Yeah.
And so what's happening with you financially, that's just one aspect of it. But oftentimes that's tied to all of these other various things that are happening in life. And I think people often underestimate the importance of career decisions and career moves and how those things impact them financially. So yes, people think about salary, people think about higher salary, but they don't necessarily think about what it takes to get to that new role and things like transferable skills, which I might have mentioned a little bit earlier. And sometimes they may get wrapped up in, oh, I want to work at this company because, you know, it'll look super sexy. And they realize that they're going to have to work more hours. They're going to have to do more of X, Y, and Z. So while they may make more money, they're going to start spending more money because, again, they're going through that mental zap.
Yeah.
And I also think that there's an element to this of understanding your values and kind of understanding your vision, because when you don't have that North Star, that also makes it difficult to be able to get back on track. So even if things are going crazy in your life, to be able to say, okay, I know that I still want to get to XYZ. I know that these things are really important to me. As much as I'm struggling, I'm going to slip up, but I know that I still need to keep these things top of mind.
That's a great point, because budgets are great, but budget for what? I like the North Star analogy, like pointing your budget in the right direction, because you see people have these phenomenal budgets. You're like, but where are you headed? I don't know. I mean, you can very succinctly put all your money in envelopes for nothing.
Oh, I've done it. Well, not the envelopes, but I've made a budget and just said, okay, you know, oh, these are all my expenses, and not even thinking about cutting expenses. It's just, this is the lifestyle that I want. This is the lifestyle that I want to maintain, which is very short-sighted, which I'm thinking, you know, I'm enjoying this spacious spot that I have today. I'm enjoying this nice car that I have today, but it's not really tied to anything in the future beyond the next 12 months. And it was once I really did that exercise and said, okay, where do I want to be? Okay, I want to get to a place that I could be an entrepreneur full-time. I want to get to a place where, you know, I wake up and I'm not saying what happens if, because that happened to me a lot when I was in debt. And I think that was part of the stress that came out is, you know, I had the money where I could pay off a lot of the debt probably faster, but I chose to probably pay a little bit less so that I would have more in my pocket to do more fun things as
me too.
as us millennials tend to do. But once I kind of realized, and once I actually spoke to a financial advisor, and that was the real reality for me, is when they said, hey, you're talking about doing X, Y, and Z, and if you're going to live where you live and you want to work for yourself, then you need to consider this or you need to consider that. And I very quickly realized that I had to make some changes if I was ultimately going to get there. So I think that really drives home the importance of kind of having that vision and knowing where you're going.
Well, and that's a great hack, by the way, that worked for me, just that you kind of skirted around a little bit. But for me, this is what worked. Like you, I always wanted to have that little bit of cushion there just in case, right? But like you, as a spender personality, if I've got money in my wallet, I'm going to spend it. Like, I totally am going to spend it. So what I had to do was I had to make sure that just in case money was never there. And then our brains are incredibly smart and we don't give them enough credit. And it's funny, the second that I made sure that money was just out of reach, that what if money, I would find more creative ways to handle the problem. And it was incredible. If I didn't have money in my wallet and I didn't have my debit card or a credit card in my wallet and I'm on my way home, I can't stop for food. I have to go home and cook, because once I get home, I don't want to go back out. I don't want to grab my wallet and go back out. I'm home. I might as well cook. And so that forced me to start cooking at home, these hacks about knowing who I was. Very funny.
Also, what I found really helpful, so I just given a little bit of context to this. I used to keep all my money in one bank account. And so that I would pay bills out of that account. I would spend frivolously out of that account. I would put business expenses in that account, which was obviously a no-no. And what really helped me was when I set up different bank accounts for different purposes and then use direct deposit from work to fund those different accounts. And so there's one debit card that I might have on me on a day-to-day basis where I say, okay, this is the frivolous spending, or this is the day-to-day expense account. This is the traveling account. And now when I look at these other accounts and I think about dipping into them, because we all have that temptation, but when I have an account labeled travel and I'm going to dip into it to say, buy these headphones, which I did not do, it's it gives me a check. It makes me pause for a second, because now I'm saying, all right, I set aside this money specifically for travel, and now I'm dipping into it for something that's not related to travel. Is this really the best decision? And having those various accounts for various purposes has actually acted as a check for me.
I love it. It works. It's worked so well. Back when I was a financial planner, it worked so well for so many people. We're getting some great comments here in our Facebook group. And let's highlight a couple of these. Gregory says, we can definitely relate. My wife and I both have long days. We end up spending far more than we would otherwise on food. Those long days, Rich, are so dangerous. They are dangerous.
Oh, yeah. It's brutal. And I'll be very honest. I've had months where I've spent over $800 on food. Probably over 1,000, just being completely honest with you. And I was doing the math on it. And so consider this. I'm fortunate enough to have breakfast and lunch paid for and covered at work. So I realized that like that's an opportunity that a lot of people don't have. So consider that that's all between dinner and weekends.
Yeah.
So ordering out 4 nights a week, Friday night, Saturday night, you know, that's time with Boobalkins, McCuddlesworth. So we're probably going to have lunch and probably have dinner out as well. And it adds up really quickly.
Yeah.
And a lot of what happened during the week was a result of that exhaustion. So I can definitely imagine what that's like for folks with families and how that becomes a multiplier for each person who's in their household.
Well, and I know, and I'm working on this right now, when we moved to Detroit, not only were we juggling all kinds of new responsibilities, setting up a new house, setting up a new life, so the days were pretty long. So we went out to eat a ton the first quarter of this year. I also gained 20 pounds doing that, which I'm now on this quest to leave. When you go out to eat, it's not the healthiest stuff either.
No, it's not. We're definitely not fine dining at keto restaurants.
Right.
when we go out, you know, it's pasta, it's steak. And because I think there's also when you're going through difficult times, there's also this, I deserve to treat myself.
Yes.
I deserve to do this.
Yes.
And then that's when we go out and we have the meal that's, you know, $125, $150. Or, you know what? I've been stressed. We're going to do this last minute trip because, you know, live life lavishly. And we're going to go up to Napa, and then it's wine and it's more meals. And that is something that I did recently, but I did plan for a bit. So I give that as an example. But I think that also plays into it as well. So I did have another blurb that I wanted to read for the article.
Yeah.
Good with that?
Yeah. Cool. Nope. Go ahead. And then I've got a couple more comments here, then we'll move on.
Cool. So it's not just a spending problem. It may be easy to criticize millennials for simply spending too much, but there are other issues at play as well. Terry Kalsten Schwab's executive vice president of investor services tells CNBC Make It. Quote, spending is not the enemy that we think that it is, she says. As a generation, millennials are also facing systematic financial issues that can feel overwhelming. They can generally carry more debt than previous generations did at their age. For example, one major reason for that is student loans. Mm. The number of households with student loan debt doubled from 1998 to 2016, Pew Research Center found. The median amount of loan debt generations carried was $19,000, or excuse me, the median amount of loan debt millennials carried was $19,000, significantly higher than Gen Xers' balance of $12,800 at the same age. So, student loans, a very real topic. And I'm not sure if it's just me, but it feels like probably over the past 6 months or maybe even over the past year, it feels like student loans has really heated up as the hottest topic, so much to the point that I can't even remember what the previous hot topic was that was holding folks back financially.
I feel like it was the whole burning down of real estate, Detroit evaporating, all that stuff. I mean, we came off of that right into student loans, I feel like.
Yeah. You know what? That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That it would have been real estate before this. But this is something that's a real struggle. And we had a guest on previously who talked about, I think they said from the time they graduated, the cost of going to school had went up like 300 or 400%. And I think they mentioned for tuition, room, and board, when they went to school, it was like $10,000 total. And I kind of did a double take on that. And so now we have, you know, people who are coming out of school, and then tie into that the whole conversation around the value of education. And you think about the Great Recession. And I think that was really a turning point as well. And also tying this back to the career side of things, where now there are jobs that may pay, you know, $19,000-$20,000, maybe a little bit more than that now. And there were jobs that previously didn't require a bachelor's degree that now they expect people to have a bachelor's degree to even apply for those basic jobs. So you have people who are acquiring these huge amounts of debt, thinking they're going to get out and have these immediate great returns. And then they end up kind of being indentured for however many years of their life. And then I'd also read separately that the folks who end up with the biggest chunks of debt are those who actually end up going to grad school.
Yeah. And which, you know, the ROI there sometimes is either ill thought out or not thought out at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to highlight that part. And then another blurb here, student loans are not the only kind of debt millennials hold. About 40% of millennials, defined here as those 20 to 35, so I'm just outside of this cusp on the wrong side, have credit card debt, according to a recent survey by Lightstream, the online lending division of SunTrust Bank. Millennials between the ages of 25 and 34 each had an average of $36,000 in debt last year. Excluding home mortgages, according to Northwestern Mutual's 2018 Planning and Progress Study. Rising home costs and the fact that salaries just don't go as far as they once did to cover the necessities also add to the pressure. And quote, when you're saddled with student loan debt, when you have credit card debt, when you don't have a lot of financial literacy, that can lead to you making unhealthy decisions with your money, including overspending.
That's so exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking this is where all of this non-essential spending comes from. It's an emergency escape valve, right? All this pressure and screw it, I'm going out to dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the financial literacy part, I think, is really key. And one thing that I've started really asking guests when they come on our show is about, we often ask about people's experience with money growing up, but getting a sense of if that person received any of that financial know-how or any of that financial education that some folks had when they were growing up. And I think about the difference between myself and my significant other. I make more, but she probably has a lot more money saved than I do because, you know, she comes from parents who instilled a lot of those financial values and a lot of those financial nuggets so that she would do things like invest in her 401k and match that right away. Whereas, and I as much as I hate to say it, I didn't start looking to max out my 401k contribution until probably the past couple years.
Yeah.
And before that, I was doing I want to do 1%. I want to do 2% because I want to have this little extra bit of money in my account and not really understanding the value of compound interest, which actually the podcast has helped me get my life together. And so I think about that part. And for someone who starts having those financial conversations earlier on versus someone who has those conversations later in life, that's going to impact them even more in terms of how they think about making financial decisions. Because while she might ball out and, you know, and sign up for the wine clubs and things like that, she's also making sure that she's taking care of her long-term future first. And she's going to have more years of compound interest while I have to grit my teeth and do the clenched fist at how many thousands of dollars I've left on the table over the years.
Yeah, I was the same way, man. I mean, I spent my late 20s and into my 30s, most of my money going into building a business. I got lucky that I built a business that I was able to sell, so I was able to catch up with that. But for a lot of people, you get that late start. It's so difficult. I want to get through a couple of these. We're running out of time. James questioned something, and you may have questioned this too, Rich. Let's put that up on the screen. 380 millennials in the survey, though, that seems light to draw such a big conclusion on percentages living paycheck to paycheck. Totally agree on the takeaway, though. I focused most on earning more when I was paycheck to paycheck, and luckily that worked out. But I thought the same thing as James. 380 people. That's not a huge survey.
No, it's not. And I also considered with that people who may be signed up for Schwab that, you know, a lot of these folks might be white collar professionals. And just given where I am, I mean, I'm a white collar professional. You know, I work at Google by day. So I was thinking probably a little bit, this is probably a little bit more skewed toward people who are lower middle to middle class versus folks who might be in different situations or who might be more blue collar. But I do think a lot of the principles apply to millennials. I do think a lot of the thoughts and a lot of the mindset apply to millennials in general. I mean, how often have we talked about the idea of keeping up with the Joneses?
Yeah.
And there was a study that we referenced, and I don't have the specific link handy, but that there are people who would rather who would pay to essentially have less money if that meant that they would make more money than everybody else versus others making $500,000 and them making $250,000 and them still being in a good spot, but not being on par with those folks who they consider their peers. Yeah. And so when you see people having these various life experiences and so on, it does feel like you're missing out, and there is some pressure there with that. So while this is a small sample size, just based off of what I've experienced, the people that I've interacted with, and just what I've been reading and seeing online, I do think it still carries some weight.
Yeah, takeaways are pretty good. I put Robert's on the screen, but Robert, we're going to come back to you. I'm going to go to Gregory here. Gregory said, we also end up spending money on things that save us time elsewhere, such as a grocery delivery service. Though I'd say for us, that's a great value. If you're spending a little more to make more, like if you've done that ROI, Rich, and I'm going to save myself this time and I'm going to spend that time 10xing what I spent, that's leverage. That's fantastic.
So I totally agree. And there was a point, and I'll make this real brief because I know we're running out of time. There was a point where I'd signed up for DoorDash, rest in peace. Munchery, rest in peace. And it was a meal delivery service for every night of the week. You'd go in at the beginning of the week and pick out all the meals you want. And to me, that was a time savings, and it was worth it because I thought about the time it would take to come home, sit down on the couch, figure out what I want to eat, or talk to my significant other about what we want to eat and do the, what do you want to eat? I don't know. What do you want to eat? What do you want to eat? Then the time it would take to order, then the time it would take to go get the food. And it worked out that dinner every night was costing me an hour of time that could be spent working on something that was going to build my business. So I do see the value within that. The problem is when you take advantage of these services and then you don't translate that time back into value.
Right. Yes. Yes.
So that's probably what I would say to that. And the last thing not is just that a quote that I bolded here is you need to find a strategy that works for you and allows you to have both rewarding life experiences and save for the future. So I thought that was a good way to close this one out. There was another part here, but I think that kind of sums it up.
I think that's a fantastic takeaway. And I'm going to go back to Robert's, then I'll make my takeaway. Yep. Robert says, we're definitely guilty of going out to eat when stressed out, but we usually have a constructive conversation about what stressing is out. So they're spending a bunch of money while they're out to eat, but they're chatting about what's stressing them out. So, you know, it ends up being a nice ambiance spot.
Robert, I really appreciate that because I don't know that every couple is good at doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually having a conversation about like these underlying factors and being vulnerable with each other, which is a whole other conversation in itself. So maybe I'll find an article related to money conversations in
for
the
next
future,
month.
But appreciate that one.
Yeah, for next month. My takeaway from this is that I think if you get if you have good financial controls, but you find the real root of the issue, I think that's a better game than just trying to solve the financial short-term and obvious stuff. I've made this point before, but there's the short-term and obvious, and there's a long-term and not so obvious. And I think we got to look at the longer-term, not so obvious solution. Hey, in just a second, everybody, Rich and I are going to do what we call the big idea. And I'm springing this on Rich because of the fact that he's running ragged today. But Rich, I don't know if you'd know that we do this, but we're going to take both of these headlines and you and I have to come up with a big idea that kind of bridges the two. How are we going to do that? I'm going to give Rich a second to think about what his big idea is while I explain to everybody about our sponsor, AcreTrader. AcreTrader, I really like because of the fact that you're investing in something that's super boring. And what's funny is when I say boring, usually you go, yeah, no, thank you. But for a lot of us, boring is a good thing when it comes to investments because we want to set it and forget it. Well, nothing more set it and forget it than investing in farmland. Now, instead of having to buy into an asset class where you had to spend a lot of money to buy a complete field or a whole farm, AcreTrader splits it into little tiny pieces. And with as little as $1,000, you can own a little slice of farmland. It doesn't go up and down the same way that you'll find commercial real estate and residential real estate goes up and down. It provides cash flow every time that the farmer pays their rent. You end up getting money. And by the way, the farmer doesn't have a good year. it's not on your back because you're not a farmer. All you are is renting the land to them. And that's a key thing. When I first heard about AcreTrader, I was really worried about farming sounds difficult and I don't know that I want to be in that. You're not in that. You're just a landlord to farmers. And certainly it does go up and down. Also, the reason that this is available right now only to accredited investors, that's a whole nother topic. You'll want to look that up. But for accredited investors, it's a great way to get money into an asset class that in the past you weren't able to before places like AcreTrader. There's a lot more to go over, but I think I'll let you take it from there. Head to AcreTrader.com/MWF. That's Money with Friends. Almost at Stacking Benjamins. I feel like I'm still at the same place over there. All right. We've got our big idea here. Do you know what yours is?
Yeah, I'm going to try to keep it pretty simple.
That's what I was going to say. Do you want to go first? Do you want to go last?
I can go first.
So, all right, deal.
I'm going to say stay financially woke. And so by that, I mean understanding your full financial picture. And going back to the first article, I was thinking about how I really didn't understand some of the things that were in the various investment funds that I have within my 401k. And understanding how what's happening in the market and how what's happening in the world could impact those funds over both the short and long term. And then also understanding who we are as individuals, spenders versus savers, values, vision, and understanding our overall financial picture. Because I also don't know that how many people are good at having a regular time where maybe they sit down every week or it's every morning or whatever it is and look at how things are going. Because I think for me, had I done more of those sit downs earlier on and looked at my spending patterns. And now I get an email every day that tells me, and I'm like, oof, yeah, I'm having a stressful week. By looking at my financial picture, it probably would have tipped me off to some of the things that were happening in my life that I wouldn't have been able to see objectively because I was so deep in them.
Yeah. That's so much better than mine. Mine is, I'm just going to borrow again, like I often do. Long-term listeners or viewers are going to kind of roll their eyes, but I'm going to go back here, Rich, to Stephen Covey and Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And it's that most people spend their time in what he calls pot three. Pot one is things that you control. Pot two is things that you control and influence. And pot three is things that you don't have any control or influence over. So we want to spend our time with things that we can control. And I think I did that wrong, but I think pot one is things you can control and influence. Pot two is just influence. Pot three is things that you can't control or influence. And I remember a mentor of mine saying, maybe it's because it was drilled into me by this mentor, I would start talking about something like politics or oil prices or these headlines that we had in the first piece. And he'd go, that's pot three stuff. You can't focus on that. I mean, don't get me wrong. You got to know what it is. To your point, you got to be financially woke, but you can't focus on that. Focus on pot one. What can you control? And I like our discussion where it went with your piece about living paycheck to paycheck, because that's something that you can, at the very least, influence. You might be able to ask for a raise. You can get your budget together. You can put controls in order. You can do all these things. And that really is a better use of time, and probably why today you and I spent so much more time there than we did on Middle East oil prices and where the stock market might or might not be headed. So that's my big idea.
That's a pretty good big idea. You did good. You did good.
Well, thanks, Dad. Just trying to keep up with you, man. Hey, tell everybody before we sign off here, what's coming up? What can the people expect at Paychecks and Balances?
Yeah. So we just released a debt-free starter kit 4-week course, which you can find by going to paybal.co/debt. If you want to check out the podcast and also our blog, you can go to paychecksandbalances.com. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at paybalances. I am on Twitter at I am Rich Jones, as well as Instagram, the same name. And we're on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances.
And if you are walking the dog or on your commute, we got you covered. We will have links to Rich and to Paychecks and Balances on our show notes page at moneywithfriends.net, not .com, moneywithfriends.net. Rich, man, this has been a blast. We got you again next month. I can't wait.
Yeah, looking forward to it, Joe. Appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everybody, go stack some Benjamins. We'll see you next time back here on Money with Friends.
This show is created and hosted by Joe Salcihi and Bobby Rebel and is a joint venture of BRK Media LLC and Stacking Benjamins LLC, copyright 2019. Our engineer is Caden Thompson. And for a list of our friends who appear on the podcast, head to our website, moneywithfriendspodcast.com. You can also check out our schedule for upcoming recording sessions so you can join us and be part of the show. As with anything, remember you shouldn't take advice from any of us or any other video or podcast without first talking to your financial advisor, and that the people in this episode are here for your and their entertainment purposes only. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and we'll see you back here next time with a real episode of Money with Friends.